Was the Progressive Conservative Party of Canada hijacked by another entity 10 years ago? What were the key differences between the Party of Confederation and the Canadian Alliance then led by Stephen Harper? Is there any political vehicle left for reclaiming Canadian sovereignty? With the 10th anniversary of the very last Progressive Conservative Party of Canada's leadership convention having come and gone as of May 31st, we probe that convention and its fallout with Marie-Elena Ripoll, campaign manager for one of the key players in that leadership race. On today's program, the David Orchard campaign, 10 years after the deal. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 6th, 2013. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. On May Day 2013, the police poured tons of tear gas on tens of thousands of workers and youth in different quarters of Istanbul, Turkey, in order to stop them from approaching Taksim Square. The government had decided that this square, the traditional venue for May Day celebrations and home to daily political actions big and small, was to be shut to demonstrations this year because development work was being done on a massive scale involving huge excavated pits, making it dangerous for crowds. Exactly 1 month later, on Saturday, June 1st, the masses protesting against the urban plans behind this development work and against the government itself had captured the square and made it the freest part of Istanbul, or rather of Turkey. The police withdrew that afternoon from Taksim Square to abandon the place to the thronging crowds of protesters, unfathomably numbering in the hundreds of thousands. The symbolism is striking. This is the biggest defeat for the AKP government and for Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan ever since the party came to power a decade ago. That's from the article, Turkey, This is a Revolt, Not Yet a Revolution, by Sungur Savran, dated June 5th, 2013, originally posted at Socialist Project. Most fair-minded people would agree that some of Manning's information was beneficial to the public's right to know, revealing details of human rights violations and exposing corrupt government officials around the world. However, the conventional wisdom within U.S. government circles and the mainstream news media is that Manning's wholesale release of secrets to WikiLeaks endangered civilians who collaborated with American forces in Afghanistan and elsewhere and impaired U.S. foreign policy by revealing the frank opinions of American diplomats. Yet while it may be true, although it remains unproven, that some innocents were put at risk and that U.S. diplomacy has been made more complicated, Manning's unauthorized release of hundreds of thousands of documents must be weighed against the U.S. government's hiding of hundreds of millions of documents. The simple truth is that the vast majority of those secret documents do not represent any reasonable threat to national security, and to the contrary, the continued overclassification represents a clear and present danger to the Republic, both because secrecy undermines democracy and because ignorance makes voters vulnerable to deceptive politicians who in turn can inflict serious harm on the real national security. That's from the article Endangering Democracy, Manning's Secrets versus Overclassification by Robert Perry, posted June 5, 2013, originally appearing in consortiumnews.com. President Obama declared in August 2009, quote, "But we must never forget this is not a war of choice. This is a war of necessity. Those who attacked America on 9/11 are plotting to do so again. Never mind that out of the tens of thousands of people the United States and its NATO front have killed in Afghanistan, not one has been identified as having had anything to do with the events of September 11, 2001. The only necessity that drew the United States to Afghanistan was to desire to establish a military presence in this land that is next door to the Caspian Sea region of Central Asia, reportedly containing the second largest proven reserves of petroleum and natural gas in the world, and build oil and gas pipelines from that region running through Afghanistan. And that is from the article What Our Presidents Tell Our Young People by William Bloom, posted June 5th, 2013, originally appearing in the Anti-Empire Report. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. With allegations of prime ministerial impropriety currently flying across the floor in the Canadian Parliament, we look back 10 years to a party leadership race that set the stage for the current government. Peter MacKay emerged from the 2003 Progressive Conservative leadership race victorious after securing the support of rival candidate David Orchard on the condition he'd not merge the party with the Canadian Alliance, a right-wing U.S. Republican-style party. MacKay then broke that promise and, by the end of the year, worked with Canadian Alliance leader Stephen Harper to merge the two parties into the new Conservative Party. Orchard referred to the newly merged party as, quote, conceived in deception and born in betrayal, unquote. I spoke recently to one of Orchard's closest allies who helped provide some background for these momentous historic events and their significance today. We're joined by phone from Saskatoon with Marie-Elena Repot. Marie-Elena has been a close associate of David Orchard going back a few decades now, and was the campaign manager for David Orchard's two bids for the leadership of the Progressive Conservative Party. So, Marie-Elena Repot, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Could you give us a little bit of background on David Orchard? Exactly who was he, would you say?
Well, David Orchard is a Saskatchewan farmer. He's from Borden, Saskatchewan, who is a thinker and a little bit of an amateur historian. He's always been like that, very interested in Canadian history, and so that's his kind of starting point. And he became involved in a big way with the Canadian politics in the mid-80s when he took leadership of on the issue of the free trade agreement with the United States. It was happening under the Mulroney, right after Mulroney was elected in 84. Having declared right and left that he was not interested in anything to do with free trade, and that thing was over. Canadians voted for it in 1911. I mean, he made very many famous comments about it. One was the free trade was decided on in election in 1911. It affects Canadian sovereignty, and we will have none of it, not during the List leadership campaign or any other time. So, I mean, those are the kind of starting point that when we became involved, and it was David's initiative in writing some critical, cautionary articles about the free trade, you know, the plans. And so he always placed this free trade agreement, the plans for it, in historical context, unlike a lot of other people who only dealt with the, you know, that this is corporations taking over. We had a historical perspective, and that was what attracted some people. You know, the founding group consisted of two professors and myself and David's brother and David. We just got together in somebody's kitchen and said, "No, we have to alert Canadians." And so we started in here in Saskatchewan, and and it grew. I mean, you know, like Topsy. At one point, we were able to travel across the country with a shoestring budget, and have mass meetings. You know, that happened in the 87, 88. But up to from 85 on, it was really writing, talking, alerting, going to hearings. We had under Devine government here, the conservative government, we had free trade hearings. And of course, Devine was totally in favor of free trade, and these were supposed to be just kind of formalities, you know, about public consultations, and we more or less took them over just by our presence and David's presentation, which was very powerful. The interesting part of this thing was that the Mulroney government's plan, and they had a secret leaked document that really motivated us, which we found, you know, discovered, and we became alerted to the fact that the strategy was to do a very low-key campaign by the free, you know, by Mulroney government, not let people know what was in it, and then to isolate critics, and that was the game plan, that just sell it as something, you know, innocuous, and something to do with free, and something to do with trade, and well, this must be good, and that's how that was their game plan, and it kind of worked quite well because all the early polls indicated that the majority of Canadians were in favor of free and in favor of trade. It's like being in favor of motherhood. And it was up to us to really say, hey, there's more to this than meets the eye. And that's where David played such a significant role in a kind of deep historical analysis, and also very in-depth analysis of the free trade agreements when we finally got hold of them. You know, because they were kept away from the public too, and so it from then on it became kind of a. Here in Saskatchewan, for instance, we had a big meeting in a public library where David took the free trade agreement, and that was, you know, we had gotten our hands on, and went through it almost by, you know, chapter by chapter, with people in the audience having their own copies that we had gotten at that time from the Liberal Senate. You know, they had sent us a whole box full of them because we couldn't get them from the Mulroney government, and and people, you know, they were like students sitting in the audience going over it. So everything that David had presented was, you know, was in it. It was not something he was just saying, and you know, saying trust me and paint the free trade agreement in black colors. No, he went through it so that people actually had the content. Eh? Mm-hmm. So that was, and that has to do with David's brief law background, because he went to law school and was one of the best students in the class, and then, you know, only went 2 years.
Yeah,
but that kind of helped. You know, he has a good analytical mind, and then commitment to understanding how this fits in Canadian history, in Canada-U.S. relations.
Yeah, he brought a very strong skill set to this struggle, but I'm wondering, like, did it feel like a real, well, his name is David, a David and Goliath battle?
In the beginning, it certainly felt like that, but we also felt that we had the truth on our side, and we had experience that if people just knew, they would become active, you know, and they, so the knowledge was very, and the kind of the quality of the information that we had through David was such that it motivated people and, in, you know, alerted them, informed them, and made them more active, you know, made them more capable of challenging the myths that, you know, what we're going to get is free and it's trade. And, you know, David's presentation, what it was, it's an intensive takeover happening, and this is how they are doing it. Mm-hmm. And here you can find the information and the proof in the free trade agreement in itself, and also then in the history of Canada, and the various attempts of the Americans to take us over militarily and now economically. So that was the thrust. And my goodness, it was wonderful to see, and I was the national became very soon the national organizer, because we went national, you know, after starting here in Saskatchewan.
Yes.
To see people come to these meetings kind of out of curiosity and sometimes, you know, cynical and doubtful about what we had anything to offer. And then leaving the meetings actually very, very alerted and grateful, you know, that this information was available, and now they have an understanding. And we have a lot of testimonies of people just coming and saying, this is, you know, fantastic idea. Never had no idea. Thank you so much for doing this. And you have to go around the country. This is what we heard from the first meetings in Saskatchewan. You have to take it on the road. And so that's, you know, of course, we had to take it on the road because this thing was not just happening in Saskatchewan. But this is where we had, you know, mass meetings. Like, they were mass meetings. And we always aim for big meetings, not for little, you know, church basement meetings with a handful of people. You know, like the aim was to go big.
So you were very successful in galvanizing this big populist wave, and it ultimately led to an actual election on that one issue of free trade in 1988.
Yes, this was definitely our contribution that we empowered people, you know, to use that cliche term, that be with knowledge, so that it wasn't just something that they would have to go by instinct or suspicion, but they would actually know, and they would have the free trade agreement under their arm, you know, that they could carry it and they could point at things. I have to say that we were doing the most down-to-earth kind of work, mass work, you know, across the country, that people, you know, from Saskatchewan went to Winnipeg, and then we went to, you know, all over the place. Edmonton, we had one of the biggest meetings ever in Edmonton, and that was in 88, of course. This is all during the campaign. And that was the meeting where we were told by various sources afterwards, including people in the media, that was the critical meeting for Mulroney, because when we had such a turnout in the major convention center that people were kind of lining up on the street for around the block to get into the auditorium, the convention center, that Mulroney, that made him call the election. I mean, this is because if we can get that kind of crowd in Alberta, it's not going Mulroney's way. That better just cut this off before it can go anywhere further. So at that point, we were still doing campaigning, you know, there was no election, you know, yet. And so we thought we had plenty of time to kind of do the same thing intensely all across the country. But then it, of course, Mulroney called the election, and then we became part of that campaign.
Mm.
And
of course,
much less time.
Yeah, right? And the Conservatives ended up winning that election.
Yes. Well, winning, they won the seats. But this is very important for people to remember, that Mulroney constantly in that campaign said this election is going to be a referendum on free trade. Of course, we don't have referenda. We don't do that. But it was clearly understood that, you know, the popular vote would be against him. He would not go for he would not sign the free trade agreement. Well, of course, he didn't mean that for a second. His percentage was 43%, and the two anti-free trade parties, Liberals and NDP, beat him. But after that, you know, it didn't mean a thing, because he said, well, I got the seat, so that's it. And so the satisfaction, of course, you have to remember, in between, there was a very significant moment that the election, you know, election was forced on him also because the Liberal Senate that had initially, the Liberal Party had initially agreed to, you know, just more or less go along and pass the This is a kind of a normal legislation, and that was the Senate had declared that it was just going to, you know, that was going to happen. So the prospect was there that there would be no election on the issue at all. It would just, the free trade agreement would be signed, and that's it. And we would never know that what the popular opinion was on it. We would never find out, eh? So we, our campaign at then turned into the in activating the Senate and the Liberal Party. And so, and that was part of our, on the road trip, David was able to give to people in these big meetings the toll-free number to the Senate. And so people called, took that on as a serious task. And, you know, countless people, countless, would call the Senate. And we just instructed people to call their senator, but any other senator too. And it was a wonderful moment sometime in July of 88 that, you know, we started to get calls back from the senators, liberal senators, asking people, seriously, why are you opposed to it? What are you thinking? You know, who are you? What do you do? What do your friends think of it? You know, in your community, how do you think it would affect you, you know, or the, your community and the country? And so, I mean, people had long discussions with the senators. And so, and this is, remember, after, you know, people had gotten kind of their teeth into the free trade agreement, they knew the essence of it. So they were able to communicate, you know, what their concerns were. And so then, you know, sometime in July of that year, the Senate declared that they would not pass it. There would have to be an election. Election on it, because they would not, no ratification without the general election. And this was actually our slogan. We had used that all along, no ratification without the general election. They took it on. So this is the, you know, the power of the Senate, I guess first time in history it's done something like that. It has that capacity, and that's why we had to think about that today when everybody's dissing the Senate and wanting to get rid of it. And
indeed.
Without thought, you know. So to us, it was a heroic moment for them, but it was also something that came from us.
Hmm.
It came. They responded to us. We informed them. They had the capacity to take in information, and so it, you know, it's something that will stay with me and all of us who were part of that. Who understand it? It stay with us forever. That this is the this can happen.
Mm.
You know, it's not going to happen with the Mulroney Senate. You know, he's put 57 senators there who are all patsies. You know, every one of them.
Yeah.
And but it can happen with a functioning Senate, and that Senate was functioning, and it functioned for the Canadian people.
Well, yeah, but in spite of the moves by the Senate and this populist wave and the over, you know, support from the Canadian public, lack of support for free trade from the Canadian public, the Conservatives still managed to win, attributable, I suppose, at least in part, to Liberal NDP splitting the anti-free trade vote.
Yes, yes. Well, that leads right into our system that it's, but if you go with the, it's a referendum of free trade,
mm-hmm.
and then you can see the, Brian Mulroney is not just a liar about free trade, but he's a liar, double liar, because he absolutely declared himself to you know that this is going to be a referendum, that he's going to pay attention to the popular vote.
Mm-hmm.
So our system, you know, allows that kind of instant corruption, because we have the first past the post makes the winners think that they are kings, and this is of course what's happening with the. With Harper, you know, he's the king and king of the castle. So that's. But nevertheless, you know, it you had to take the victory in this situation, or the deep knowledge that comes out of this, which is that people can be victorious even if it doesn't, you know, we don't win the battle.
Could I maybe just get you, first of all, to just comment on why it was that David chose to use that same PC party to become, you know, to champion his, you know, vision of
The kind of obvious thing of that was, I mean, the opportunity was came suddenly was there. I mean, there was something to look at, and look at in a new way when it was the defeat of the Progressive Conservatives. They were left with two seats, you know, it was kind of the punishment for everything
that was
they'd
in 1993.
Done. Yes, and that was, you know, our system also is very weird, because of course they got many more. I mean, they, in a different system, they would have gotten many more votes, many more seats. I mean, the two seats was just part of the anomaly that we have. But nevertheless, suddenly there was no party. And then there was, Charest was the party leader, and he was would become a liberal leader in Quebec. And when he took off, eventually after a lot of pressure and demands on him, there was nothing there. So it was the leadership. There was going to be a leadership race. And, it became like, we're looking at the Progressive Conservative Party, not just as a Mulroney party, but historically it has been a pro-Canadian party. It has all kinds of progressive elements in it. It is progressive, you know, and at the time progressive conservative, although the Mulroney era kind of just made a mockery out of that. So David's, plan was to, first of all, bring the issue of free trade and Canadian sovereignty in general into the national arena through this political vehicle, and also to take back the party, you know, make it Canadian again. And the sovereignty would be the core of it, and then go back to the true progressive conservative policies of being opposed to free trade, because everybody, all the leadership candidates in 1883, had declared themselves to be against free trade under any circumstances, except for John Crosby, who was a globalizer and free trader and proud of it. But everybody else, and there was about eight of them, I think, one after another. No, never, ever. So, so David was in the line, that kind of thinking, go back to what the Progressive Conservative Party was before Mulroney. So it was really take the party back, bring the issues of Canadian sovereignty, free trade agreement into the public political arena, so people have, it's a consciousness raising, raise the national consciousness through this vehicle. And David did a lot of consultation. It was a lot of consultation with all kinds of people, including our membership and supporters and politicians of from the NDP and liberals and all kinds of contacts that we've had developed up to that point. And so the consultations went on for months, and then David made a decision that this is, and got a lot of encouragement to do that, and so that was the step taken to become partisan, political partisans, and leave behind the nonpartisan activity for the time being. I mean, we didn't know where it was going to end, but we certainly had the feeling right away that we had the capacity to mobilize a significant campaign, that we had by that time we knew that we had the grassroots support, we had support from all kinds of quarters and all walks of life, and there was a strong sense of people wanting Canada to be a sovereign country, independent country. And also David had been up to that point also one of the key spokespersons for a anti-war position, so he had also become a spokesperson against any unjust, illegal wars, and so he has that kind of constituency as well. So he had, and as an environmentalist from way back, and an organic farmer, he had that constituency too. People concerned about health and environment. So he had a large constituency to draw from, and we did that. We pulled together. In a very short time, a few months, from the time he declared himself in June 29th, 98, declared himself after. This was the 4 months of consultation.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. In what follows, Mary Elena Ripoll and I reflect on David's quest for the PC leadership crown. Notwithstanding the history of the party, Mulroney, the people who were in the party, didn't they come to embrace the
the Mulrooney vision, you know, saying like, you know, times change and so on and so forth. Joe Clark, for example, was opposed to the free trade agreement, but he came on board, as did much of the existing membership, no?
Yeah, well, also they chased away a lot of people. You know, when we were active in the PC party, a lot of former PCers came back. And these were, I would, some of them you can describe as red Tories. You know, there's a phenomenon in Canadian political history of the red Tories, who are progressive conservatives, emphasis on progressive. And there's a pile of them. They kind of feel, you know, they were felt very alienated from the Mulroney era, and with the lies and distortions and falsifications and committing us to a terrible takeover agreement by the United States. So people came back. People who had long histories with the Progressive Conservative Party came back to support David, because they recognized in him a red Tory, and what essentially David is, you know, is a progressive conservative red Tory, and so that's, you know, that constituency was there as well as we got people who've never been active in any kind of political parties, which is not, you know, it's not something very difficult to be, because most people are, you know, we have a very small, low participation in political parties. So there's a huge constituency out there who have never been involved that way, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but they joined. I mean, some of them kicking and screaming because they don't, oh, that's a crazy idea. You can't do that. You can't, you're caving in to Mulroney or something. And people have all kinds of reactions. But when they thought about it, then... And David offered them a lot of thinking material, you know. They say, okay, it makes sense. It makes sense. Why shouldn't we? Why should we just kind of be outside when we can be inside? Okay. And take on those very issues in a much broader way and in a much public way. And so we got a lot of support that way. And enough to, David got 25% of the vote in the final final ballot, you know, mm-hmm. where Clark won. It was the third ballot. Just a minute, no. Yeah, it was the final ballot anyway, second ballot.
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, and we started with 16% in the first ballot and then went to 25%. That's good enough, you know, good enough for first effort.
But David didn't walk away after Clark won.
No, and this is a very important thing, too, because Clark famously called David a tourist. Well, this particular tourist actually became a citizen of the country. I mean, he stayed and his supporters stayed, became very active in writings.
Did they influence the direction of the party in any way?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Because in various ways, in policy conventions, we had succeeded in demanding labeling on genetically modified products. There were all kinds of progressive things that we were able to do. Not alone, I mean, but by offering leadership and being kind of the vocal, articulate people in policy conventions and elsewhere, we were able to sway other people who didn't know enough, you know, or didn't know as much. So we had successes in various ways, including, you know, many of our people became active in ridings and just did the grunt work, and then we asked to take positions of leadership. And so that kind of, in the next leadership race in 2003, we had a number of people on the National Council of the Presidents. And, of course, after the incredible convention in 2003 with all the pluses and then the minuses, but we had many more people who wanted to be active. You know, so there was going to be a real revival in the Progressive Conservative Party under McKay's leadership, with David Orchard playing a significant role.
Let's talk about that campaign for a moment.
Oh, boy.
what would you say were the main obstacles that the Orchardistas, is the term I recall, that they faced?
Yeah, they tried to make us into Sandinistas, so that was their kind of a, because we're left-wing socialist, the guerrilla radicals, or something nonsensical like that. The obstacles were in every way, because there were people, of course, in particular establishment types in the party, in the Senate, and wherever they were, you know, the back room boys and the consultants and the various operators. who did not want us in the party and didn't want David to have a significant role. So there was a lot of sabotage from the central office, you know, organizing efforts in the ridings and getting delegates in and getting people involved. And so that was the nitty-gritty of that was really that was an obstacle course on every level. And the thing that we had on our side was that we had a lot of people interested and involved, and that was a very satisfying, you know, we felt that we were going to be victorious regardless because we are going to overcome these obstacles. And and it was an obstacle course. To, you know, they would do all kinds of things, absolutely mischief of organizing, you know, organizing meetings that didn't happen, or we would, our people would go to a delegate selection meeting that didn't, you know, and the address was a pawn shop in Regina, so people stood at the street corner waiting for something, you know, and nobody came. So that there was a kind of planned confusion.
So you're saying
by people who really wanted us to stay out. And I think these people were people who wanted the party to be taken over. They were preparing for the ridings to be so empty that the Canadian Alliance, Reform Alliance, whatever, could just walk in and take them over. So they had to keep us out because we were the only ones really growing the party membership. Mm-hmm. And we were growing it with people who were capable, interested, you know, motivated, and willing to do work. You know, willing to do work in campaigns and willing to work in the ridings, and you know, so these are the tourists.
Yeah.
These are, you know, that were actually stayed, and there were other people holding them back, trying to keep the doors closed. Mm-hmm. And famously, you know, in
so basically, I just want to recount because a lot of people don't necessarily know how these parties work.
Yes.
But this was a delegated convention, which means that the membership, people who belong to the party, get to vote for the people they want to go to Toronto to select the leader. So it's people aren't able to directly select the leader. They have to choose people to vote on their behalf.
Yeah, they choose the leader on the ground level. They give, and then the delegates they belong to that leadership campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And it was proportionate, so that if you got 10% of the, vote in a riding, you got that many points, you know, that many delegates, you know, accordingly. So that it was quite fair that way, and so we you know fought in every riding to get as many delegates in for David Orchard, and the first vote would go to it was automatic, so nobody could pretend to be Orchard supporter and then go and vote for something else. The people that we had as delegates were Orchard supporters. They could not falsify anything, you know. So when they committed themselves to Orchard, they came to the convention and acted accordingly, right? So that was the method used, and so that's, you know, we went into the convention with 25% of delegates, which was pretty good. We were the second after McCain.
And I take it from what you were saying earlier about the pawn shop voting headquarters, that the people who were identified as Orchard supporters were misdirected by the establishment who had been, you know, Orchard supporters.
These were the local types who were very close to, I think, close to Alliance already then, and they were there to do the dirty work to keep us out, so that the party wouldn't have anybody in these ridings, and so because nobody else was lining up to get into the Progressive Conservative Party, we were going in into empty ridings in many cases, and when some of the media people and some of the party people would say that the Orchard people were taking over, well, there was not much to take over. The door was open, and we walk in and we said, "Okay, we're here. What needs to be done?"
Okay. Yeah, and Orchard had the second largest group of delegates. Of all the delegates
that's
were at
right.
the convention.
That was really freaked out the power structure in every way. And there were some of the media commentators who were constantly bad-mouthing David.
And I think that one of the things that people tend to forget is that David didn't want a delegated convention in the first place, right?
Well, we were, you know, we had the first convention on the 98. It was a direct vote from the ridings, you know, so that was everybody could vote. Everybody who could make it to these polls, could vote. So there was many more people could participate. So, yes, the delegated thing was, you know, you fight in every riding to be a delegate, to have delegates, and so that was much more time consuming, and in every way it was more difficult. But they had kind of maybe hoped that be fewer of us, because we also had to raise a lot of money to get people to go as delegates. It's not cheap to be part of a delegated convention.
So finances is another obstacle that the Orchard Camp faced.
Oh yeah, I mean, and that's right. And then you can say, well, let's pauperize them. Let's make sure that they can't come in, even if they get people interested, that they can't send delegates. But we got the money. We got people, you know, from people who couldn't go themselves, and but wanted to be part of it. Then they would pay for somebody else to go, and that's so delegate fees and traveling fees, and so that was an incredible amount of fundraising that we had to do, and the money kept pouring in, you know. People believed in it, and it was very satisfying, because we knew we were on the right track, and we are connecting with people that for who are interested in or want to have some deep change, and the change in the direction of supporting Canadian sovereignty, you know, as a main thrust, plus the environmental policies that David was so known for, you know. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot, and anti-war policies. So we were feeling that we had the people, and we could have had them for a long time. And we, you know, I foresee backwards now that easily David could have easily been the next leader after McKay. Hmm. And because we were the only ones with growth potential from the population. McKay had no particular appeal, and has less appeal now. And David had the appeal and the connections. And, you know, that's at the time when we had about 50,000 people on our database. Mm. You know, so that's almost like a party itself.
Do you, because I seem to recall at the time that there were concerns, you know, whispers about infiltration or anything like that, you know, whether it's from other campaigns or even higher ups. Do you have any, I don't know, is that something you feel you can comment on at all?
Well, what kind of infiltration into?
Well, I mean, anything, like, even because we're talking about, like, what David's talking about is a populist platform, and yet there are the entrenched interests not only within the PC party but within the Canadian establishment that would seek to sabotage David. I think
the sabotage occurred in the ways that I've described, in the, you know, by the party agents being the agents, you know, that trying to cause so much trouble and mischief. And you know, keep doing it after the convention was over, for instance, and after McKay almost instantaneously was seduced or willingly got involved in betraying the party. I mean, not just David Orchard, but destroying the party. We also had they sabotaged us, and that was the establishment in the party and whoever their friends are, including Mulroney, of holding back David's money. You know, there was a big issue, lasted for a couple of years, of not getting the funds back that people have donated, because they donated it through the party, and it was sitting there, and it was, $70,000, maybe more, I forgot exactly how much, but we had an endless struggle to get that. And that, of course, you know, created a lot of problems, because post-convention fundraising is much harder. So we had to fundraise that money that was sitting there, or borrow it, or do all kinds of tricks to get it. So that was really an attempt to handicap David politically, and how all our efforts, and tie our hands so that they could go ahead with the merger, you know, without David obstructing them. And of course, we fought the so-called merger.
Let's just review, like, May 31st, 2003, and the decision, because David Orchard, he had the second largest delegate bloc, but two of the lower-level leadership candidates, Jim Prentice and Scott Bryson, combined their votes and leapfrogged ahead of him. And David chose to go with Peter McKay.
Yes.
Now, why did he go with that candidate and not the other ones?
Well, the alternative was Prentice, and Prentice had been a merger candidate absolutely outspokenly. At that time, McKay had been saying, I am not the merger candidate. I am not the merger candidate. So he had, you know, that was the one important thing. Prentice was not in the House of Commons. So he, you know, as an unknown entity, really, in terms of what kind of baggage he would have brought with him. But to us, it was clear that he was for merger. He had in essence, agreed to David's conditions, too. He would have done, so his betrayal would have maybe taken a different form, but he was committed, you know, committed to cooperation with the Reform Alliance people. So anyway, so that's the really didn't leave as much of a choice, you know. If Bryson would have been the second, that would have been different, because I think there would be much more. We had to give thought to the possibility that Bryson, who was not a merger, interested in the merger, or wasn't actively supporting the merger, although he voted for it. I mean, he's another shady character to my mind, because he voted for the takeover, and then he joined the Liberal Party.
Yeah, so within days. Kind of,
but at the time of the convention, he would have been a choice, and that would have been very interesting to see, what they would have done with him.
Yeah, that would have been completely different history, probably.
Yeah, he might have caved in. I don't know. He would have, they would have targeted him in a different way, gotten to him. They certainly got to McKay instantaneously. I don't think he necessarily intended, he said it various ways. He didn't think it was going to happen so fast. Mm-hmm. That's what he said. In the book by Bob Plamondon, which is a very, very interesting book to read, it's called Full Circle. And that deals with that whole convention and the merger, so-called, and ratification and so on. And it kind of reveals, you know, McKay is kind of a little bit stunned that it happened. It happened so fast. Of course, Harper and others wanted it to go. They had been gunning for the Progressive PC Party for a long time. And they had a real hatred for Clark and David Orchard. I mean, total hatred. And that was revealed in Harper's speeches, where he would, you know, mention the name of David Orchard, you know, countless times. It was like that was the target. Eh?
Mm-hmm.
And so McKay really became the only choice, because we had no capacity to go beyond the 25%. We could not challenge him, you know, so it became Prentice or McKay, and for a while it looked, you know, okay, we got something good. I mean, he agreed to all this, you know, merger, that's very important, and the review of the free trade agreement, very important, and the other, you know, and some changes in the headquarters, very important, because we've had particularly the national head of the party there. National director David Scrimgeour, is obstructing us at every point, and creating. He was the active ingredient in making it very difficult for us to mobilize in the ridings and to get delegates or even get annual general meetings. So that's one of the demands for us to changes, and also we wanted to have some of David's people there. And remember, at this time too, I had been elected as a. I was the first and only openly Orchard member of the National Executive Board, the Management Committee. So I was inside all of this time, fighting against the takeover. And from my perspective, it's very significant that the Management Committee was completely lied to by McKay. They didn't know. They were kept in the dark. Everybody was kept in the dark. All the people heard rumors that something was going on. So, but to us, McKay famously declared, when he was asked, "What is this thing about we've heard that you have talks with Harper. He said, no, the only kind of talk I've had with Stephen Harper is to talk to him about his son's hockey game. So he actually said that to us in a straight face while they were having, you know, high-powered meetings already. And all summer, you know, he started to be actively engaged in that negotiations and meetings with Harper in June, in you know, like a month later.
Before the ink was dried on their agreement, right?
What's that?
Before the ink dried on their agreement.
Yeah, well, you could say that. You could say that. So that, and then Mulroney was there, like a dirty shirt, totally involved in that. And then, of course, Belinda Stronach was one of the organizers of financers, whatever, of this whole effort too. So she, and then eventually she left for the Liberal Party. So
what I think, what I'm hearing from you here is that, because you mentioned Bob Plomondon's book, I think he mentioned that there was a lot of pressure from the financial community, trying to push them into some sort of a, push the parties, you know, into some sort of, like, either go ahead with this merger or you don't count on funding from us. But it seems to me that what you're pointing to is McKay acting beyond the democratic apparatus of the party.
Oh, totally, totally. There was no, the democratic apparatus was absolutely overridden to the point that when there was ratification, I mean, I referred to it at the time when this whole deal as a coup d'etat, you know, that and when David spoke about it, you know, as soon as we found out, it became public in September, you know, that, you know, he referred to it as an abomination, a conceived in deception and born in betrayal, which should be the, you know, plastered all over the place. This is what this so-called Conservative Party is all about. But it was interesting when one of the progressive conservative senators, Lowell Murray, described, he stayed as a progressive conservative. He was a staunch critic of this plan. And he said in the Senate, the party's constitution was twisted and bent out of shape to achieve the purpose of the proponents. For them, the end justifies the means. And then he further said, it was a coup similar to what we have seen in some countries where the constitution is suspended and a new order is ratified in a quick plebiscite. This was the party of Confederation, the party of MacDonald and Cartier. Thus was the party of Confederation, the party of MacDonald and Cartier extinguished. So he, you know, refers to that mode of completely, you know, changing the constitution, cooking up schemes by ratifying things, not allowing any participation from below, including the National President's Council, not allowing a motion by me in the executive committee. And I asked for nullification on the basis of what the party's constitution and what the party was committed to, which was to be a progressive conservative party, and were not allowed. And so basically there was no way of the party membership to respond. And then they, you know, with a concocted process, they were able to get 90% in agreement. Well, very easy, because also meanwhile the Harper's party, I mean, McKay had made it possible for Alliance members to take a membership in the Progressive Conservative Party. So they flooded our party. Mm-hmm. And so they could come into, you know, my riding. They came and suddenly there was a whole bunch of new people coming to vote. And they voted themselves in as delegates, and we didn't get any because they changed the rules so that the 50, you know, 50 plus one takes everything, you know. So everything was done in a kind of like a machine came in. And to me, it has a CIA flavor, but maybe local operators, that you can do anything, and you can't stop us. And David and a group of other PCers launched a lawsuit at, you know, stall it. And there was a second lawsuit, you know, launched also by Sinclair Stevens against Jean-Pierre Kingsley, who participated in this.
The chief election officer.
What
became of those lawsuits?
Well, we lost. We lost because it was impossible to. The takeover has taken, the so-called merger had taken place already, and there was already a party in fully functioning and going to an election. So I think the judge was very loath to do anything to, you know, I think we got patted in the back of a certain issue, part of the issues, but we couldn't stop and nullify the merger. The key argument in the court case was that if some people want to leave the party and join the alliance, let them do so. But they can't take the Progressive Conservative name. They can't take its assets. They had to be left with the people who want to stay. You know, who are party members, who have legal grounds, to whom the party belongs. And Sinclair Stevens' case had to do with the chief electoral officer allowed this to happen. He had a special meeting, allowed a meeting on Sunday for the merger to take place officially, mm-hmm. and that was to, in our opinion, everybody's opinion, to prevent an injunction that was going to take place on Monday. So Kingsley is very complicit in this, and it would be very interesting. See, the whole thing has been unexplored. It's been kind of a fact that happened. So that's it, and it's interesting. But there hasn't been a detective story that needs to be done, you know, along the lines that I'm kind of indicating here, mm-hmm. and a good investigative report could really find out everybody who was pulling strings. But I'm sure there's absolutely definite that the corporate people who were the donors. And who were the influence would be opposed to somebody like David having any kind of say in anything, you know, because of the free trade agreement, because of Canadian sovereignty, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
David Orchard is no longer involved in this no longer Progressive Conservative Party. Where is there for the, now 10 years later, where is there for the Orchard's campaign for Canada to go?
You don't have a party at the present time. We have been advocating electoral coalition, in the strategic electoral coalition between Liberals and NDP, and believe that in order to defeat Harper, well, then we also have to do something to chastise the parties because they're malfunctioning and they are not representing us, particularly in issues of war. Or the various wars that Canada is involved in, and both the NDP and the Liberals have been running after the cons, saying me too, let's bomb Libya, let's go after Syria, let's do this to Iran. They have not held back. So I mean, although I would like to, we would like to see Harper taken down completely. Well, we have a task with the NDP and the Liberals on many, many counts, but the war is the really striking on the sovereignty as well, because they're very weak. They have, you know, made peace with the so-called free trade without understanding it, and they need to be educated and self-educated, but also educated by the masses of people who know better. I mean, most Canadians are more anti-war, more pro-sovereignty than any of their representatives in the House of Commons. And there's a real gulf there.
Thank you, Mary Elena.
Okay, bye.
That was Mary Elena Ripoll, longtime ally and campaign manager for David Orchard, speaking on Orchard's campaign for Canada and the story of the 2003 Progressive Conservative Party leadership campaign and its aftermath. For more background on Orchard's issues and the leadership bid, or to order a copy of Orchard's book, The Fight for Canada, Four Centuries of Resistance to American Expansionism, visit his website, www.davidorchard.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.